BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
So the proper way to do it is to cover the right hand hole and I'll give it a blow. So that should have been 2600 hertz.
2600 hertz is a tone all hackers know. The origins of hacking come from a few tones, a few kids, and a whistle.
Davy Crockett was a guy in the 1930s and 40s, and Davy was in a Woolworths one day, and he heard a demonstration of a thing called the Davy Crockett Cat and Canary Bird Call Flute, which is a little plastic toy for kids that if you blow on it, it would make a noise with a slight warble. And it clicked in his head and he said, I can use that to spoof operators.
I'm Gabriella Coleman, a professor of anthropology at Harvard. And this is The Hackers, a series that delves into the hidden histories of hacking and uncovers how it's shaped the world as we know it. We're starting right back at the beginning of it all with the phone freaks.
My name is Phil Lapsley, and I'm the author of the book Exploding the Phone, the untold story of the teenagers and outlaws who hacked Ma Bell. And the book is about phone freaks, people who in the 1950s and 60s and 70s were exploring the biggest and most available computer and network in the world, which was the telephone system.
It's hard to imagine, but the first phones were rented in pairs and calls were made point to point. I mean, you literally needed to have a line between your place and whoever you wanted to call. By the 1880s, calls were routed through human operators. Most were women who worked at central switching stations. They'd connect callers, unplugging and plugging direct wires on their switchboard. All this was coordinated by the Bell Company, which was a monopoly in the United States. And the service was not cheap.
And as a result, there were a lot of people who wanted to figure out ways to kind of get around this. You know, a simple example is like, well, you got a payphone that you're going to deposit coins into. Well, what if I deposit little metal slugs? Or maybe even, what if I freeze water in the shape of a nickel? Other things that would happen, there was in the day a thing called a collect call, where you would call somebody and they would pay the charges. But what you could just say is, hey, operator, I want to make a collect call to this telephone number and my name is Myron P. Zimidsky. And when the operator calls and says, hey, you have a collect call from Myron P. Zimidsky. Do you accept the charges? They just know, oh, Myron P. Zimidsky is code that tells me my kid has gotten to wherever they're going safely. And I say, no, thank you, operator. And I hang up.
These were everyday hacks. Anyone could do them. But for freaks, there were far more interesting tricks they could do thanks to Ma Bell's automated system.
When the telephone company started automating this stuff in the 1930s and 40s, the way they came up was with a series of tones, which were called multi-frequency tones, a little bit like touch tones, but different, that the machines in the different central offices used to communicate with one another. And it's a brilliant solution. It worked really well. It had one giant flaw, which was the same circuit that was being used for your voice when you would make a call was the same circuit the machines used to communicate with each other, which meant if you knew how to imitate those tones, you could actually spoof the machines and take over parts of the telephone network.
What began with whistling became more sophisticated as freaks developed what became known as the blue box, which was often not even blue. This device automatically generated the tones needed to infiltrate the phone system.
So let's say we're talking about a long distance call. What's going to happen is there's a pair of wires that goes, say, between California and Colorado, because that's the next stop on my way to New York City. On one of those pairs of wires, both machines, both switching central offices are sending a 2600 hertz tone. And that just marks the lines as idle. And when I pick up the phone and dial, and the switching equipment starts to route a call through Colorado, on the San Francisco end, it's going to take off 2600 hertz to say, hey, Colorado, I need to make a call. Colorado, in return, is going to take off 2600 hertz to say, okay, I gotcha, I'm listening now, tell me where you need to call.
Then San Francisco sends out a burst of tone representing the telephone number.
And at that point, the Colorado machine's like, ah, okay, cool. You're calling this number. I know how to get there. As that system was working, they would send their own burst of 2600 hertz down the line using this blue box, which is a little electronic device which generates tones.
It would only take a fraction of a second. Send your tone, turn it off, and the Colorado line would think the call had been terminated. But the San Francisco line is still up and operating. then all you have to do is send another burst of tone down the hack line and you can call any number you like.
Now, you might say, well, this is kind of dumb, Phil, because I've now taken a long distance call that I made to New York, which is going to cost me, you know, $30 or $40 or $50 during the daytime, and now I'm routing it someplace else. How is that saving me any money? When the phone company introduced 800 numbers, which were toll-free numbers, that was a way of you making a long-distance call that would still go over the same network that didn't cost you anything. And so now you could make dial an 800 number call and then use 2600 hertz to reset the call, use your blue box to reroute the call to somebody you wanted to talk to for free, maybe even someone internationally, and the telephone equipment would be all too happy to let you do that.
And freaks called a lot of places. They called other freaks, friends, love interests, even the Pope. A lot of them shared a sense of humor, but they had other traits in common.
Is there a typical type of freaker?
The most common is, let's call them, the technically curious freaker. And those are the people who tended to be young men, let's say anywhere from, you know, 13 to 18 years old. They tended to be kind of geeky or nerdy. And they tended to have deep curiosity about how things worked and a certain kind of obsessiveness. It wasn't really about making free phone calls. It was really just more about wanting to understand how does the telephone system work? And then, okay, if I do X, Y, and Z, I ought to be able to defeat that, which is, you know, the same thing that motivates a lot of hackers today.
When I was a little kid, maybe 4 or 5, my dad, who was a technical director of a telephone company, took me to one of the sites that he was working for, and I got to see my first ever computer, which was probably the size of like 3 or 4 wardrobes with tape reels. And the thing that really attracted me to it was just this huge red enter key. And that's kind of where the bug started.
This is Belial, a hacker and one of the last classic phone freaks active in the late 90s. While Ma Bell's technical secrets had been unveiled by American phone freaks, the BT or British Telecom network was largely unexplored. So Belial and friends got to work.
I kind of recorded all of my explorations of it and uploaded them and mapped it out for people to be able to learn.
And to discover technical secrets, they had their own automated tools. And with these tools, they're able to go to strange and unusual places.
One of the main activities that a phone freak does is called war dialing. So you basically have an application and by some way you configure it to essentially go through a whole list of numbers. And the war dialer will try and figure out what's at the other end of the phone.
Is it a fax machine? Is it a computer? Or something a bit more exotic?
We managed to find a phone assignment block for a specific large UK shopping center. And one of those numbers went through to an automated system and you could call through to the tannoy. You know, when they say like, you know, the spillage in aisle 3 or something like that. And what one of the options was the Lyft telephone emergency system. And we were like, oh my God, we've called a Lyft. And then you could hear people like shuffling and talking and stuff coming into the lift. So we thought this is going to be amazing. So we tried to get as much hilarious stuff pre-recorded because obviously we couldn't stop ourselves from just like absolutely blubbering and laughing. So that would have not kind of had the desired effect that we were hoping for. So we tried to record some really serious kind of things about the lift breaking or something with a countdown or something stupid like that. So that's kind of what we did. And yeah, we were all doing it all at once through like a party line.
That social aspect was intensely important to the phone freak subculture. Party lines were a big part of the scene, even from the earliest days. They were secret spots you dial into where you'd likely find your friends hanging out, ready for some talk or action. Phil Lapsley again.
Well, I think maybe in some way, think of like perhaps a speakeasy or something like that. Again, remember, you're a phone freak in the 1960s or 70s. There aren't very many of you. You're doing an illegal hobby. This whole thing is kind of edgy. Now imagine being able to use your own skills and wiles to create really kind of the first electronic meeting places. In one case, it turns out the phone freaks using their blue boxes found a conference call system that was for AT&T executives, and they took it over. Imagine a group of teenage kids hanging out, basically being king of the network and having this kind of secret underground party on the telephone network. The amazing part is what these kids would do is they would learn enough about how things were set up in a telephone company central office, and they would call and talk to telephone company switchmen, the technicians who work in the telephone company central office and maintain the switching equipment, and they would BS them into doing things like setting up a free conference call circuit so that they and their buddies could talk to each other. You'd call them up and you'd tell them, hey, buddy, I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And then while they were like considering, should I be doing X, Y, and Z, you'd say something like, tell you what, while you're doing that, I'm going to put you on hold and I'm going to call the traffic engineering center in Kansas City just to let them know that you're doing it, you know, just to double check. And so you're covered. Don't worry about this. And the guy's like, oh, okay, well, that's pretty good. You're calling the traffic engineering center. I'm not going to get in trouble for this. Cool. Thank you for having my back.
Ma Bell wasn't exactly a fan of freaks, but going after those meddling kids was tricky.
When you prosecute a teenager for being smart enough to figure out how to hack the telephone system, guess what? It winds up in the newspaper. And when it winds up in the newspaper, a bunch of people end up learning about phone freaking who wouldn't have known about it before. So it becomes that conundrum of, you know, we're making phone freaks faster than we can prosecute them.
So a lot of the freaks got off with a scare and a slap on the wrist. This started a change around 1971 due to one splashy article on these technological spelunkers.
Esquire magazine had published an article by a guy named Ron Rosenbaum, and it was called The Secrets of the Little Blue Box, and that brought phone freaking to the mainstream. And so suddenly the phone company had this problem that now, okay, we don't really need to keep this a secret anymore because everyone knows about it. So the phone company adopted a new attitude, which is we're just going to start prosecuting people. During this time, during the late 1960s, the phone company did manage to get a precedent established that using a blue box across state lines to make a free phone call was in fact a federal crime. And so now they were sort of well positioned to start going after people. And so starting in the 1970s, several hundred phone freaks were prosecuted. For the most part, it tended to be a fine and restitution and, you know, unfortunately for some people, potentially a felony conviction.
I'm sorry, we are unable to complete your call as dialed.
Things weren't quite as harsh when it came to freaks in Britain. There had been a few cases, the biggest one in the Old Bailey in the 1970s, but by the time Bilal was freaking, things were a bit different.
I honestly don't think they cared. I've spoken to BT engineers, and one said to me, actually, they don't care about people like us. They care about other phone companies abusing BT's own test systems. So I think that's probably more where they were bothered, but I honestly don't think BT had the resources or the care to go after one individual messing around on their systems or potentially doing some level of revenue fraud or something like that by making a free call somehow through their network.
Students who take my hacker class sometimes think of freaking as a blip in the history of hacking. That is until they learn that the two Steves, Jobs and Wozniak of Apple fame, were phone freaks. Phil again.
I think of the phone freaks as being the first network hackers. These were the people who came up with the idea of, hey, what is at the other end of this network? How can we explore it? And Steve Jobs, there's a lovely interview of him talking about what an amazing, powerful experience that was for him. And he says, had we not been involved in blue boxes, there never would have been an Apple computer. So you can certainly trace a lineage of kind of the sequence of events that caused Jobs and Wozniak to partner together and have such an amazing experience that they wanted to go out and do more amazing things, which led to Apple Computer, which led to lots of technology we take for granted today.
Freaks fell away as personal computers replaced the phone system, and the baton was passed on to a new generation of hackers. These people would go on to do extraordinary things, but they would always be indebted to the early pioneers. A few tones, a few kids, and a whistle.
Hello, I'm Professor Steven Pinker. We all want to reason more clearly and to make better choices about everything from life and love to medicine and money. But even the best of us get things wrong.
I would have twice as many billions if I just made a different decision.
I mean, of course, one can always learn from other people's mistakes.
It's ideal to do that.
Each episode is a conversation with an expert on rationality and someone who deals with our corresponding irrationality in real life.
Rarely do we sort of walk around living out probabilities. Oh my God, wait, 90% prevalence. It's hard to sort of hold on to that in real life.
I hope you'll join us as we try to make sense of making sense and hopefully to make better decisions. That's Think with Pinker from BBC Radio 4, Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.